Hello, I'm Cara Cox, Marketing and Design Coordinator for MediaSoc. In today's episode, George is joined by Rebecca Vincent, journalist, human rights activist, and Director of International Campaigns and the London Bureau of Reporters Without Borders, otherwise known as Reporters Sans Frontières. Rebecca will be sharing some insights into the results of this year's World Press Freedom Index, and why this is so important in light of the current global health crisis. You're listening to Insiders, the Oxford University Media Society podcast.
Thanks so much for joining me, Rebecca. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thanks. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. So to start off with, it would be really great if you could introduce yourself to our listeners and perhaps just give us a very, very brief insight into your background and perhaps tell us a little bit about the work you do at RSF.
Sure. Well, so I'm Rebecca Vincent. I work for Reporters Without Borders, which is known internationally as Reporters Sans Frontières. So if we say RSF, that's why. Since 2016, I've been the UK Bureau Director. I opened RSF's first office in London, and I've been running it since. And actually, as of today, I'm now taking on a new global position. I will be the Director of International Campaigns. So that will take me into more of our global work, but I will continue as well to focus on the ongoing work we have here and to run the London Bureau as well.
Great. Thank you very much. And congratulations on the new role too. So what did you do before your stint with RSF? Am I right in saying that you come from kind of a human rights background?
I do indeed. So I've worked for about 15 years now in the field of human rights in different capacities. I started my career as a diplomat. That was only brief, about 3.5 years at the start of my career for the State Department, because I'm a dual national. I'm originally American and also British now too. But that was the experience that really made me fall in love with human rights work. So when I left the State Department, I came and did a master's in human rights in London at UCL and started working for NGOs, non-governmental organizations. I've worked more broadly in other areas of human rights, but I've worked really heavily on freedom of expression always throughout my career for bigger international NGOs and actually as well for smaller NGOs. I worked on and in Azerbaijan for quite a long time, was at one point kicked out of the country in connection with my work with local human rights groups there, and then moved back abroad and was coordinating big international campaigns really until I came to RSF. But I knew RSF because they had very often been involved in the international campaigns that I had been working on. And I was really drawn to their provocative, creative campaign style, which is what I'm still doing now, nearly 4 years after joining.
Good. And RSF is probably, most people will be familiar with RSF who are listening at least, and will be aware of the Press Freedom Index. And you released a few weeks ago the 2020 Press Freedom Index. I was just wondering if we touch very briefly on that, what kind of broad trends, I guess, we've seen over the last 12 months. So if we compare 2019 and 2020, what's going on in the world, really? Sorry, I'm aware that's a really open-ended question, but perhaps if there's any kind of key turning points we've seen.
Sure. Well, just maybe just a brief word about the index itself in case some of the listeners aren't as familiar with it. We've been putting out the World Press Freedom Index for 18 years now, and through it, we rank all 180 countries in terms of their performance on press freedom. So you can see a ranking if you kind of glance at the index, but if you click through, you can also see a country scoring and see over time how it's performed against itself, even in specific subcategories. Sometimes that can be a very helpful tool as well, because the rankings are, of course, relative to the performance of other countries. We tend to put this out each year just before World Press Freedom Day, which falls on the 3rd of May each year. So usually in mid to late April, we release the new edition of our index, which is what we did this year as well. And actually, it was very hard work. Our team was very dedicated to ensure that that got out as normal in the midst of, you know, a pandemic and with all of us working remotely around the world. We were very proud to be able to get that out as usual. Now, this year's index pointed to, some trends which have been deepening for years now, which is, you know, press freedom is under attack around the world. In many ways, it's getting worse each year, as even the countries that have been thought of as standard setters are slipping. And that did contribute to some of what we saw in this year's rankings. But as well, these sort of global crises. So of course, coronavirus has to be mentioned, because it was, of course, a global crisis that started not in the calendar year that we were looking at. So the index data focuses on a calendar year. So that will look at January through December 2019. But we combine it with our analysis at the time that it's released. So that the index is really a snapshot of the time that it's released. And so clearly the first several months of this year, that had become the overwhelming crisis in the world. But there were other crises that pre-existed it. So geopolitical crisis, crisis in trust in media, economic, technological, sort of all of these things that have really made it difficult for independent media to survive around the world and that have opened the door for further violations of press freedom in many places, even in countries that we used to think of as safe. And that's one thing. This was not as much highlighted in the index itself, but another resource that we produce that is updated daily is our barometer of press freedom violations. And at the end of the year, we publish an analysis as well of the trends in each calendar year. So when we look at the trends for 2019, even that, you know, that were underlying before the index scores were released, fewer journalists were killed last year than for many years prior, 49 journalists, in fact, in the whole calendar year. But that doesn't mean that the world got safer. What we saw that was really disturbing was, although there was a decline in the number of journalists killed in conflict zones and in places that we've always thought of as being more dangerous for media, there was an increase in the targeting of journalists in countries that are meant to be at peace, and an increase in deliberate targeting of journalists. So a higher number of journalists were deliberately pursued and killed in connection with their journalism than ever before. So that really calls into question everything that, you know, we think we know and how we engage with our own governments, even in democracies. It was heartbreaking. Last year, we actually had a journalist killed in the United Kingdom. Lyra McKee was killed in the line of duty, observing rioting in Derry, Northern Ireland. And if it can happen in the UK, it really can happen anywhere. We cannot be complacent about safety of journalists or press freedom more broadly. So going back to the index, we have, you know, this situation where we know journalists are at risk in countries that they never would have been at risk in before. And in fact, truly globally, if we're looking at journalists being deliberately targeted for their work, they can be targeted anywhere. Then we're looking at the set of converging crises in the world that was seriously exacerbated by coronavirus, and that produced this year's index. And at the time that the index came out, we were a month or so into the lockdown, and now this situation has accelerated even more. But we're seeing now a new wave of violations related to the pandemic. So I think two things going on there. One is some states have used the pandemic as an excuse to carry on with their pre-existing crackdowns or to accelerate repression, safe in the knowledge that with the rest of the world preoccupied with fighting the pandemic, that little will be done to hold them to account for their behavior within their own borders. But we also have a new set of violations, states that are working to repress accurate reporting on the pandemic, states that are retaliating against journalists and media that question the official narrative. All of these things are happening. And so that was present in the index. And it has even become a bit more concrete since then. These trends have been solidified, I think, in the weeks that have passed. And, you know, the trends within it that we've seen from a number of years that were present this year as well, which was declining democracies, a rise in the strongman model around the world, figures like Donald Trump, Bolsonaro, Duterte, this sort of, you know, these sort of strongman figures that have really taken a heavy hand towards the media and feel emboldened to do so. We saw even in some democracies that hadn't been previously problematic, I'm thinking of Australia, which performs better than some on the Press Freedom Index still, but we saw a series of newsroom raids on the homes of journalists, things being done in the name of national security there that were really concerning for a democratic country. But we also saw some success stories, and I think they're always worth mentioning because so much focus goes to sort of the worst performers and the negative trends. Every year, there are a handful of countries that rise up remarkably in the index, and that really shows that it is a question of political will to address these issues. So I think this year, the Maldives and Malaysia in particular had very significant improvements. This is almost always when you have a change in government or a change in that, you know, the head of government, which does show it is that question of political will. You know, and it also highlights that we hope that our index can be an advocacy tool, not just a tool to name and shame the worst offenders, but a tool to help states identify areas that, you know, are problematic and to help them improve their press freedom performance in the year going forward.
Okay, so some success stories in amongst some pretty disheartening news. You mentioned just then towards the start of your answer, you said that we'd kind of seen a slipping across the board, which I thought was quite interesting. I mean, if we look at the Press Freedom Index, historically, we've got kind of the Nordic countries at the top, for example. But do you think that even in, you know, these countries which consistently rank quite highly, we've seen a turn towards perhaps slightly more difficult conditions for journalists and news organizations?
Absolutely. And one thing I will emphasize is that no state has a perfect record. Even the countries at the top, yes, the Nordic countries do perform very well, but even in those states, we see examples of violations. Actually, across several Nordic states, there was an increase in cyber harassment of journalists this year. So we can always find examples of things like that. And it should be a constant process of states trying to improve, regardless of where they fall in the index. One thing that I've noted in my travels is the only country that I've ever been to that did not complain about its rank on the index was Norway, which is currently number one. Many countries are sort of unhappy with where they fall, but it's, you know, that's consistent across the board too. After you get out of the top, you know, the very few at the top. It's funny, the countries in the middle and the countries at the very bottom also complain about their rankings, but it is quite an involved process. It's quite a data-driven process. The index is compiled by a panel of experts in every country that fill out a very in-depth survey that covers 7 different indicators and really gets at the whole climate, not just, you know, a few criteria, but the broader climate for press freedom in any given country. It doesn't just capture the behavior of states, it captures other areas of the climate too that can be influenced by other things. For example, if a journalist is killed, very often it's not at the hands of a state, but the climate that allowed for a journalist to be killed is of concern, right? So we try to capture the whole range of criteria there. And the reason for one country's ranking as opposed to the next, they can be quite different because there can be quite different reasons that a state performs poorly or well on the index. So it is worth looking at all of those things. But you do see certain trends, sometimes regional, sometimes international. Most of the trends that we highlighted this year were truly global in nature. And it's really disturbing when we look at how regions perform, that even the region that has long been the best defender and protector of press freedom, which is Europe, has been slipping for a number of years too. The Middle East and North Africa remained the most dangerous zone for journalists.
Something else I'd like to pick you up on as well, just from that initial answer. You said that we're seeing kind of the current pandemic accelerating repression in some regions, which I think is a really, really important point to touch on. So if we look, for example, I'm thinking about China at the moment, we've seen more than ever before, I guess, kind of citizen journalists being pursued by the regime. I'm thinking, I don't actually have the name to mind at the moment, but I remember that we saw one citizen journalist broadcasting from Wuhan as he was essentially being pursued by what he claimed was an intelligence officer. And that almost, I don't know, it almost felt like it kind of fell away from public view. Do you think that regimes are kind of getting away with things more than they would in normal circumstances, and will they be held to account afterwards?
I do think that there is a lack of accountability, and I think that predated the pandemic. That is a problem that we've long highlighted, is sort of, you know, that oftentimes even our democracies that are committed to championing press freedom abroad, they don't always do enough to hold the worst offenders to account in the best of times. And so now, with this added crisis, and with every state really focused on public health of its own citizens, and in some cases, like their, you know, a global role in combating this as well, that is even more the case. China is worth highlighting in that regard, because obviously this pandemic started in China. Reporters Without Borders has argued that if the press freedom situation were better in China, if whistleblowers had been able to really sound the alarm, if the media had been more independent and able to report accurately on the full extent of the problem immediately, we have argued that a pandemic could possibly have been prevented. It is impossible to know, but we do know that the reporting that came out was delayed, that it was not accurate. And that contributed to the spread of this global health crisis. And so this is an example of how press freedom matters in very concrete ways. Sometimes it can feel like a more theoretical discussion when we talk about these things, but the pandemic really highlights that actually freedom to information, access to information, is a crucial part of global public health. So China, this is a state, and many of the other states that have been working to repress reporting on the pandemic, were already among the worst performers in the World Press Freedom Index. China is now at 177th. And the policies of information control have been deep-seated there. In fact, you mentioned citizen journalists. China has nearly a third of the world's imprisoned journalists in prison in China alone. And many of those are citizen journalists, over 100 journalists in prison in China, where we have nearly 400 cases of journalists imprisoned all around the world. So China is by far the biggest jailer of journalists. And all of these things really did contribute to their handling of attempts to report on this pandemic. And then we saw retaliation as well against even foreign media, foreign correspondents that were in the country, and then, you know, tried to report in an independent manner, questioning the government's figures. We saw a number of journalists expelled from China because of that. It's not just China, though. Other states at the bottom of the index, Iran also took that sort of approach to media in the early days of the pandemic as well. We saw cases of retaliation against journalists. We saw suppression of accurate reporting. Some of the countries at the very, very bottom, North Korea and Turkmenistan are usually neck and neck for the very bottom places on the index. This year, North Korea slipped back to 180th and Turkmenistan right above it at 179th. And those countries, I believe, are still reporting zero cases of infection, which is simply unbelievable and shows really that the concept of these states even pretending to respect, you know, the role of media or press freedom is an absolute joke. So yeah, it's you can't really divorce how states have reacted to this from their pre-existing behaviors when it comes to press freedom. But this has certainly accelerated those sort of acts of repression and given them cover in a way, because they know that even more so than in the best of times, they can get away with these things, and that they are likely to get away with it even in a post-COVID world, as states are going to be looking to resume business as usual fairly quickly. So groups like us are trying to, you know, raise the alarm now, because we're very concerned about what the world looks like on the other side of this, what journalism looks like, what press freedom looks like. And these behaviors will all contribute to the society that we emerge in when this is over.
Mm. And I mean, I think we're seeing this emerge by the day pretty much. We've literally just seen Brazil essentially delete all of the official statistics available relating to coronavirus cases in the country, right?
Yeah, and that's absolutely an act of blatant censorship. And often it's not quite so blatant as that, but these sorts of behaviors are taking hold in many, many countries. So far, we've tracked coronavirus-related press freedom violations in at least 64 countries. So over a third of states in the world, we've got documentation of COVID-related press freedom violations. And I say at least because there's some places that we simply, you know, don't possibly have enough information. So there are likely to be more examples.
Mm. And at RSF, you're obviously kind of monitoring the current situation as it unfolds in the context of the pandemic. But I imagine you're also dealing with, you know, kind of past abuses of press freedom. And I guess I was wondering, are you kind of worried about what this will mean, what the pandemic will mean for historic abuses of press freedom? So do you think that, you know, these incredibly important stories, like, for example, the assassination of Daphne Galizia, are at risk of, I guess, being forgotten or kind of falling to the wayside just because we've got this kind of new challenge which has presented itself?
Yes, that's a real challenge. And I'll come to cases of murders of journalists like Daphne Caruana Galizia in a minute, because we do continue to campaign on those. But one sort of area that I want to mention is the imprisonment of journalists. You know, there are at any given time usually close to 400 journalists in prison around the world. Most of those journalists have been left to languish behind bars now at the additional risk of being exposed to COVID-19 in prisons. And their cases have largely been forgotten internationally now. So we have really serious humanitarian concerns for journalists in many countries that never should have been in prison in the first place. And now with this, of course, they have the additional risk, but yet the world is paying even less attention to them than before. So that's not just a question of historic, you know, abuses, but like an ongoing violation of deprivation of liberty. And now states that are leaving them in this situation are, in fact, intentionally exposing them to additional risk. So those would be the states that are, you know, the biggest jailers of journalists. So I mentioned China earlier, also Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Turkey, states like this. But, you know, even here in the UK, we have Julian Assange in prison at Belmarsh prison here. He has underlying health conditions and he is facing great risk of being exposed to COVID in Belmarsh prison. So again, it's an example of where we haven't always got it right in democracies either. But yes, in terms of campaigning for, let's say, historic, you know, abuses like murders of journalists, most of those cases, it's very hard at the moment to get significant attention. We tried to find hooks where we can. So anniversaries and things like that in cases are still moments where we can try to get, you know, some more attention again. At the moment, a lot of the sort of campaigning that we usually do is online. So there's been, you know, I've taken part in a number of virtual vigils now on many cases and looked for other ways to sort of creatively engage people online. But it is getting harder the longer this goes on. One thing as well is that the pandemic has meant that judicial proceedings are frozen or delayed in many places. And so you mentioned Daphne Caruana Galizia's case. Basically, proceedings came to a halt for several months. The courts have recently reopened, and now the compilation of evidence against one of the murder suspects, Jorgen Finnick, has resumed, I believe, just last week. So that's now ongoing again. And the public inquiry, which we advocated quite heavily for last year, will be starting again this Friday. So things are slowly, slowly starting to open back up. But while those things were frozen, possibly that was a needed step for public health, although we've seen other countries that have managed to carry on with some degree of court proceedings and find creative solutions, for example, of doing things remotely as well. In some places it came to a standstill, but in places like Malta, where it did come to a standstill for a while, that was just an added prolonged period for that family to be dealing with not just their grief, but, you know, exacerbated by the lack of justice and knowing that there was no recourse during that period. So I think it's positive now that things will resume. One thing we'll be concerned about is access to observers and things. The media, obviously, that's a case that's of high public interest, and we need reporting, independent reporting, to come out of that, especially right now, because international observers like me, because that would be the sort of thing that in normal life I would attempt to be out in Malta sometimes monitoring myself, as a number of other international organizations that work on the case would do as well. We can't travel, so we're even more reliant on local independent media having access to that. So we'll be looking at things like that, like how that will be respected in practice as judicial procedures start to open. And we're looking at that in other places. I mentioned that some countries are doing things remotely. Open justice has been an issue in some examples of that. There's been there have been a number of barristers that have raised issues with various cases here. One that I've been personally involved in is, again, the case of Julian Assange. I've monitored a number of administrative hearings now on the telephone, which was the option given to us, and it really wasn't sufficient. It made it almost impossible to properly follow what was going on. And there are a number of other concerns in this case. And so one thing that we've really highlighted is the need, because it is of tremendous international public interest, there has to be better provisions made for the press and for observers. So far these have been administrative hearings in his case, but they're looking to resume the full extradition hearing in the case brought by the US. At the moment, that's been postponed till September. But one thing that Reporters Without Borders has called for is for the hearing to not continue under lockdown conditions. So at the moment, we don't know what the UK is going to look like in September, but if it's still needed to limit numbers to the extent that has been the case during lockdown, possibly that trial should be postponed even further, because again, we need to be able to, as observers and as the press, to scrutinize proceedings. And so, and then there's other aspects of the case too, that as the prison is locked down, his lawyers have not had access to him. So that affects their ability to defend him properly as well. So they've requested a number of things that the court has not given. They've requested him to be released on bail. That was denied. They've requested many things that are just sort of being ignored at the moment. So there are a number of concerns in that case that are all coming together as the pandemic continues and as lockdown continues.
Becca, so could you perhaps just touch very briefly on the involvement of the US in the Assange case as well, please?
So Mr. Assange is being held in the UK, but it's on the basis of an indictment against him in the United States. There are 18 different counts against him. 17 are under the very problematic Espionage Act. We're really concerned because if he is extradited to the United States and tried there, this could be the first example of a publisher being convicted under the Espionage Act, which would have a really chilling effect going forward on anyone wishing to publish leaked materials. So that is precisely, we feel, why he's being made an example of, why the case against him has been so heavy-handed. So we have different angles. In the UK, we've been calling for his release. We were really disappointed that the Home Office greenlighted the decision, basically the Home Office greenlighted the US extradition request. So it allowed it to be considered by the court. But there was a chance to stop this politically. It did not have to be an active matter before the courts. Now it is. We continue to call for him not to be extradited to the US and for him to be released. And in the US, we call for the charges against him to be dropped, as well as broader reforms to the Espionage Act, because it has been used against a number of other whistleblowers and journalistic sources. So the Trump administration's abuse of that law is becoming increasingly problematic in parallel to a broader erosion of press freedom in the United States.
And I think that's probably quite an important point to touch on, especially if we're looking at kind of very, very immediate events and kind of what's unfolded even over the last fortnight or so, you know, in the wake of the George Floyd protests. I mean, it's almost hard to know where to start. We've seen journalists in supposedly, you know, a liberal country attacked. We've seen videos of a Deutsche Welle correspondent being shot at by police with rubber bullets on a live broadcast. We've seen Australian news crews attacked and the kind of police body cam footage published, as well as, you know, like exponential growth in the number of complaints made regarding treatment of the press in the States. I guess, Have you been surprised by what we've seen? Or as you've just mentioned, do you think that given the treatment of the media and, you know, this kind of gradual erosion by the Trump administration, have we basically, you know, been set up for this? Was this to be expected?
I think, unfortunately, it was to be expected that the sort of hostility that the Trump administration has fueled, this portrayal of journalists as enemies of the people, you know, fake news media, corrupt media, all of these terms that have really been ingrained, you know, into those who support President Trump and those who follow media that carry these sorts of stories, or even those who look at his social media accounts. This has been so repeated over a number of years now. I think it's unsurprising that it's now fueled physical violence. He has a lot to answer for, not just in terms of what's happening in the US now, but the international standard that it has set, because we have seen these, I think I mentioned the strongman model earlier. We have seen Trump-like figures popping up in other countries too. But now we see a widespread manifestation of police violence against protesters in the US, or not just protesters, protesters and journalists, more bringing it to our mandate, journalists. There have been attacks by protesters against journalists as well, but the vast majority of the incidents that are being tracked are police themselves behaving completely brutally towards journalists, intentionally targeting them, and seemingly safe in the knowledge that they will not be held to account for these actions. So we are part of the US Press Freedom Tracker Project, which is compiling data daily. And it has been, I think, since the early Trump administration days, this project has been in place. But they're doing particularly brilliant work at the moment, tracking the violations related to the protests. And I glanced this morning, the latest figures, there have been nearly 400 documented incidents against the press since the Black Lives Matter protests have broken out in the wake of George Floyd's killing. So those include incidents of arrests of journalists and also attacks against journalists, ranging from being shot at with rubber bullets and other less lethal projectiles, such as pepper balls, being tear gassed or pepper sprayed, and facing other forms of violence. This is completely unacceptable in the country of the First Amendment. It would be unacceptable anywhere, but particularly for a country that had long been sort of viewed internationally as a sort of beacon of democracy and freedom, to really be so aggressively targeting the media and in such a systematic way. It's very clear that it is a question of impunity, because this is not just a few police officers behaving this way. It has happened across, I think I saw a tally, across 33 states, if I'm not mistaken, in a number of cities, sometimes multiple cities in a given state. This is a question of systemic abuse of the media, and it sends a really worrying signal to the rest of the world. So we have nothing but admiration for the courageous journalists who are continuing to get out to do their jobs to show the world what is happening. And we are doing everything that we can to ensure their protection. And I think in the aftermath, we will be doing everything that we can to ensure that those who perpetrated these attacks are brought to justice. But unfortunately, this goes hand in hand with this broader erosion of press freedom that we have seen in the US. The US is now ranked 45th out of 180 countries on our World Press Freedom Index. And, you know, the whole climate has eroded under the Trump administration. We mustn't forget either that the year before last, we saw the massacre of newsroom staff in Maryland at the Capital Gazette newspaper, which, you know, would have also been unthinkable in previous years in the United States. So this is not the first instance of violence against journalists, but it is the most alarming manifestation we've seen of systemic abuse by authorities towards the press. And there's not been enough by the rest of the world really in sort of condemning these practices and working to hold the US to account. So I think all of our states have something to answer for in terms of needing to do more to make it clear to the US that this behavior will not be tolerated internationally.
Absolutely. And do you think it's realistic to expect that there will be fallout in some way, shape or form? I was going to say once the situation dies down, which perhaps isn't the right turn of phrase, but, you know, looking ahead into the future, you know, I think a lot of people were left, I guess, astounded at seeing kind of a CNN reporter arrested live on television. It's unthinkable, really.
It would have been unthinkable. And now it sort of does seem par for the course in the United States. That has to change. That particular footage of the CNN crew being arrested, I found very chilling. Because it seemed very clearly intended to send a signal. They knew that it was live on air. The news crew did nothing wrong. They, from what I could see, broke no law, offered to move, and then were arrested in a very calm and calculated manner, again, knowing they were live on air. To me, that sort of embodies this entire attitude towards the press in the US right now, is sort of that they knew that they were fairly confident that that could happen with impunity. So it's hard to say what will happen next. Obviously, the situation remains very fluid. And our first and foremost concern right now is the safety of journalists that are trying to do their jobs, because, again, this reporting is very highly in the public interest. We need this to be documented. Remember that the media are also documenting abuses of others, like, you know, violence towards protesters and other human rights abuses that are ongoing now, that we would have no documentation of whatsoever if journalists were not on the scene doing their jobs. I think there will have to be some very serious actions taken at some point in the United States to address all of this. And we're starting to see some changes already in terms of accountability for some police officers that, you know, had triggered the wave of protests in the first place. But it's clearly not gone far enough, and it remains to be seen what will happen specifically to those who perpetrated violence against journalists. But we can't take this out of the context either of the election coming up in the United States this year. And we hope that press freedom will be an important part of the discourse in the election period, that, you know, respect for the role of media. This attitude has to change in the US. This is really not in fitting with the US's own values and laws. And of course, the First Amendment being this sort of symbol of freedom for the whole world. Something has to change. And it should not be such a politicized issue. But unfortunately, the behavior of the Trump administration has made it a very highly politicized issue. So we will be watching closely as the protests continue and in the aftermath, and doing what we can to ensure protection now and then justice and accountability later. And also what lessons can be drawn from this so that we can help to work to ensure better protections of journalists going forward, not just in the US, but for the rest of the world too. Because that's the danger. If there is impunity for this in the US, you know, other countries across the globe now have more of a carte blanche to behave as they want towards their own press, right? If the US cannot hold itself to account, the US has lost any influence it might have had in raising these issues in other parts of the world. And our countries, and I include the UK in this, like other democracies that aren't doing enough either, they're contributing to that, you know, to that sort of, I've used the term carte blanche several times, but it is that they're contributing to that sort of feeling of being emboldened, of that, you know, that especially authoritarian regimes will take the signal very clearly that this behavior is acceptable in the international system. And I think that is very dangerous indeed, given that we've already seen a global deterioration in press freedom for many years now. Adding this sort of fuel to the fire will only serve to embolden those who wish to use violence and other means to silence critical voices and independent reporting. And that is what we must protect everywhere.
And I think you've made it completely clear that this is by no means a problem which exists only in the US. And I think it's interesting in that, from my point of view, at least you might disagree here, but it seems slightly different here in the UK, in the sense that at the moment, you know, if we're looking at these kind of very immediate protests, it's less of a question of police violence and kind of targeted attacks on news crews and on the press, but I guess we're seeing public opinion and we're seeing hostility from protesters. I mean, if we look at the protests outside Downing Street, central London, there's a lot of videos of news crews kind of giving live reports, and you can hear protesters chanting F the media in the background. And I'm just thinking about the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, when they published their Trust in Media report. You know, looking at the UK especially, trust in media has sunk to kind of an all-time low, pretty much.
It has, and I think public officials have a role to play in that. I think there's been a part of the reason we're seeing an increased hostility towards media has been intentionally fueled by some figures. We don't have such a polarizing figure in the UK as Donald Trump, but we do have a number of public officials that have behaved with total disdain towards the press or open hostility. That has been an issue in recent weeks in the UK. We raised concern over the government's response, particularly Downing Street's response to a number of reports that were in the public interest related to the government's handling of the pandemic, and in particular, the situation with Dominic Cummings. We were really concerned to see serious reporting dismissed as having come from quote-unquote campaigning newspapers, and a number of other responses by governmental bodies to recent reporting that it didn't quite use the term fake news, but it would be things like false allegations or false report. You know, it was getting at it in a more British way, perhaps, at the same thing. It was intended very much, we believe, to undermine the credibility of these publications and to turn public opinion against the media. So for weeks now, we've seen a number of senior officials that repeatedly say things like, don't believe what you read in the papers, don't believe what you see on TV, essentially telling the public not to trust the media actively. And it's no coincidence then when we see in the same vein, this scum media hashtag trending on Twitter in the UK, and then shortly thereafter, a manifestation of violence from protesters that were there for very different reasons. They weren't there to attack the media, but just seeing, you know, the journalists there trying to do their jobs enraged some to physically attack them. And that is really dangerous. So public officials who are fueling that, and I do believe a large degree of that is intentional, public officials that are fueling that hostility do have something to answer for then when it erodes the public's trust in media and actually sometimes results in real life violence. It is a very slippery slope and one that I think has to be reined in immediately. So that's what we're calling for here in the UK, is for immediate action to sort of reverse this before it becomes a more entrenched trend. And I will use this term here. I have referred to it repeatedly as Trumpian, because these are Trumpian tactics towards the press. And is that the sort of country that we want to be here? We have performed better in terms of press freedom than the United States. We had some downward trends for a number of years, a slight downward trend this year. It was mostly issues related to the safety of journalists in Northern Ireland and the continued detention of Julian Assange that contributed to a drop for the UK this year. We're now at 35th out of 180 countries. But now is the moment to break away, to stop following the US down the World Press Freedom Index, to show that we mean what we say in terms of our own values, our own laws as a society, to make sure we're getting it better within our own borders, and then to do more to seriously hold our allies to account and the worst offenders, the countries that we very often shy away from doing enough to ensure accountability. So Britain has this opportunity, Britain has this ability, and that's what I would like to see going forward from this country, is all around sort of an improvement. And that starts with the very government officials that have been towing this dangerous line and that have been fueling this hostility that has to stop now.
So on a very personal level, you know, if we're looking to affect change, is this a case of thinking critically about what public officials are saying and at the same time kind of seeking out high quality journalism, good reporting?
Yes, absolutely. I think that's one thing that is within everybody's power, is to support quality independent media, pay for media, right? Subscribe to quality media and support it financially, because one thing that we haven't touched on in this, and it's not always viewed as a press freedom issue, is the financial future of media, the survivability of media past all of this, because we're already seeing an alarming number of local newspapers having to close, bigger media outlets having to lay off journalists. If we don't have media on the other side of that, that makes a lot of the rest of this less urgent, because we need independent media to survive. So on a very basic, immediate, personal level, everybody can do their part, if it's within their own, you know, economic resources, to make sure that they're supporting quality media. I'd say also to engage with your MP. I mean, and there's other political things that you can do, but one thing that we can all do is to write to our MPs when we see these things that concern us. Many, many MPs are actually very good at responding to constituents. And so even if it's not somebody that you think would have a good track record on these issues, I've seen examples of MPs that have been mobilized if they've gotten, you know, inspired by constituents reaching out about certain issues. So I'd say, like, never write off your MP assuming that they won't be helpful on these issues, because at a bare minimum, they may take up some degree of this in terms of casework. You can also ask MPs to do things like table questions, oral or written questions about issues like this. You know, you can do other things more publicly. People, you know, when you're looking at student journalists, possibly people will be taking to social media or blogging or these sorts of things. I think attention to these issues, even at, you know, small level, just to start, is really important. You know, and just things that you can do maybe on a grassroots level. You can't at the moment really go out. Well, we are seeing protests, of course, but it's hard at the moment to mobilize in person, you know, around specific causes and cases given the lockdown. But, you know, there are often groups like us that are out protesting things happening in this country, or sometimes we're outside foreign embassies, you know, raising issues in, I don't know, it's Saudi Arabia or Malta or Turkey, for example. There's always things like that that you can do on a grassroots level. But whilst we're all stuck at home, one very easy thing is to help give those sorts of causes some visibility on social media. We're all on social media a lot at the moment, and I think even a bit of interaction there right now can be more visible than people think. And I think there's a need for more positive engagement around this online. We are seeing an increase in intentional trolling. I mentioned the scum media trend, you know, these sorts of things. Why don't we have more positive discussions around this too? Share good pieces, talk about things, you know, that matter to you, and sort of even the sort of reaching out to your own MPs and things. You can have an online component of that too, that might actually help inspire others as well. So I think there's different levels that people can get involved in, but there are things that all of us can do, even on lockdown, that can help counter these really worrying trends.
A lot of really great thinking points there. And you've also got plenty of resources and the latest news on the RSF website, right?
So absolutely. You can find the World Press Freedom Index. You can find this barometer that I mentioned, the barometer of press freedom violations, that shows the number of journalists killed by country. It's updated every day in the number of journalists imprisoned. We also have a Tracker 19 project at the moment. You can find it off our homepage, where we're collating all the reports of COVID-related press freedom violations all around the world. So that's a handy tool to play with at the moment. So all of those things are on our website. And if anybody's so inclined to donate as well, even very small donations can help organizations like ours a lot too. So we recently added the ability to donate in pounds. So if anybody in the UK would like to donate, that goes to RSF UK and the campaigning work that we do here. That's always very much appreciated. So it's rsf.org is our website. And if you do /EN, that takes you to the English version of our website.
Fantastic. I mean, thank you so much for these insights, Rebecca. It's been super interesting. And thank you so much for this incredibly important work that you and everyone at RSF is doing.
Oh, thanks very much. And thanks for the interest of all of the students listening to this. I think we know that we need good people to go into careers in journalism now more than ever. And so I hope that if anything else, that or if nothing else, that people will be inspired to stick with their studies and, you know, to seek jobs that will allow them to report on all of these things, or even possibly work at organizations like ours. We have a lot of journalists that work with us too. So all of these things are possible, but we really need young people to take an interest in this and to you know, to pursue these careers now too.
Thanks so much for listening. And thank you, Rebecca Vincent, for joining us today. If you are interested in finding out more, you can find the World Press Freedom Index on the Reporters Without Borders official website. More information about Media Society can be found on our website at www.oxfordmediasoc.com. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you again soon.